Well, what an adventure I'm having today, just getting started. All kinds of interference. I hope you're out there. This is Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead on PRN.fm. And I've had to erase a whole bunch of things so that we have no further interference. And now I have no notes, but we will wing it. And we will wing it because our guest is, he doesn't deserve to be winged upon, is Charles Ortel. And we're going to be talking about the situation that is developing that is bringing together a spectacular carnival, a real interesting concatenation of things. Charles, are you there?
I am indeed, Eutrice.
Oh, I'm so sorry about, I don't know what happened, but all kinds of things were zooming in. And when I first started out, I heard Donald Trump's speech, a stumping speech from last year, and I definitely don't need to hear that. But let's move on.
It was the Ukrainians.
It was the Ukrainians. Oh my God! How do we intercede with the Ukrainians to ask them to behave themselves? Okay, but we go in. Charles, I wanted to know. You've been observing what's going on, and it looks, in some cases, I'm sure it looks very different from what you have experienced before. But considering that you have done a lot of work, that brings people out of the woodwork to come together to work on special projects, things that they share, ideas that they share, money that they will make together. What do you make of what's going on right now?
Well, I think, you know, on the political front, the resistance is stubborn, and the resistance is doing all that it can, and it's a bipartisan resistance. It consists not only, obviously, of the defeated Clinton wing of, and for that matter, Obama wing of the Democratic Party, but the Never Trumpers, who I would argue include the Romney team and many other members of the country club established wing of the Republican Party are doing their level best to slow down and, you know, maybe even try to stop what Donald Trump is doing. Meanwhile, you know, economically, which is really where I start focusing, the world since about, I mean, it's simple, oversimplifying to say it this way, but since December 31st, 2008, the world has really been in a desperate state where we have far too much productive capacity around the world. In places like China since then, tens of, well, frankly, trillions of dollars have been invested to put up more factories and more office buildings and more supply. And all the while, machines and technology are and robots are replacing human labor. And in addition, we have this propensity to pile on ever more debt on the global economy. Some estimate that as much as three times global output is out there in the form of debt. It's a crushing debt load. So we're really in a very dangerous place economically, and many government, our government, of course, and our economy is almost a quarter of the world or 20% of the world's total output, yet we're less than 5% of the population. So I focus on what's going on here, not just because I'm an American, but because it what happens inside America spreads so far all over around the world. And, you know, the one corner of the world in the U.S. economy that has not been disrupted yet, has not availed itself of the major technological benefits that are out there for large organizations, is our government sector, which today it consumes about $6 or $7 trillion of our economy every year. That's an enormous amount to spend. So internally, we've got this logjam. We've got professional politicians who, you know, can literally find themselves in jail and still get reelected, some of them. At federal level, we have an unresponsive bureaucracy or obstructive bureaucracy, and then we have many, many problems, you know, internationally, whether it be with ISIS, or, you know, regional conflicts, intractable national civil wars, and a lot of weapons at the ready, a lot of people with their fingers on triggers who, you know, could get us into conflagration very quickly. So, you know, it's a dangerous moment. And then, of course, we have our own Federal Reserve signaling that they might raise interest rates. And when they do that, the values of all assets denominated in dollars, most assets will go down. So the speculators, the investors with the money are very nervous. And, you know, these are not the good old days. I mean, the last time this country, in my view, had a long period of uninterrupted growth was around 1981, 1982 through to the Clinton years. Towards the end, they were very frothy, of course. But that was a long period of growth. Since then, from 2001 to the present, what we have is, you know, America's been at war for 16 years, four times the length we were at war in World War II, and we have little to show for it.
So do you withdraw the prediction that a big crash is coming, or do you stick by it?
I absolutely stick by it. And, you know, it's going to become apparent in the numbers that are shortly going to be released for the second quarter results on these big publicly traded companies. I think we're days away now from when we'll have a steady stream and flurry of earnings reports. And, you know, I go, as you know, and some of your listeners know, I'm ancient, 61. So I remember... I remember the good old days in business school when we were taught that and I got out in 1980, for a company to be something you really want to own, you should see what's called top-line growth, increase in revenues that are generated not simply by financial gimmicks, but by new customers buying more products than they did last year, ideally at higher prices and better margins. And since 2008, you really haven't seen that. You've seen a lot of gimmickry. You've seen these big multinational companies with massive PR machines spin the idea that they're a lot better off, and that's why you should pay their CEOs $20 million a year or more. When, you know, you look under the hood of the financial reports, as I like to try to do, with people like GE or General Motors that was supposedly safe, and you'll see there's no joy in Mudville. I mean, the revenues are in many cases declining or artificially propped up by low interest rates, by government spending that is channeled into these companies one way or another. And, we can't go on for much longer in this way. There's too many negatives, not a lot of positives. We're seeing, for example, you know, on a related small note, we saw the great fanfare, people arguing that, you know, McDonald's, you know, starting out workers ought to make $15 an hour. And they tried that in Seattle. And look what's going on in Seattle. And look how McDonald's is reacting. They're introducing robots, you know, and vending machines to replace these workers. And sadly, you know, the brutal reality of global life is that while things are challenging inside the United States of America, we're actually a very rich country relative to the rest of the world. And when you start pushing up through regulation and other means, artificially, the cost of labor, the reaction in these businesses, even at McDonald's, which is, after all, just a chain of restaurants, is to figure out how to take human labor out of the productive equation. And so, you know, we've got a massive amount of excess labor in the private sector. And then in the government and academia and really the government and academia world, those workers are protected by unions, by tenure, by the fact in academia that for the good schools, there's no shortage of people who will pay the massive amounts of money that need to be paid to get you through one or two or three degrees. And so there's this gross inequality going on in the position of workers in the private versus the public sectors. And I think we're spoiling for a fight here, and it's going to come.
Do you see signs of it already, especially as it relates to China?
Yes, I do, actually. You know, that's an interesting one. When you, I won't go, as I said, I think last time, I won't go full nerd on you. But but I will get a little bit into the weeds. So when you talk about the progress of an economy, many in your audience will know the phrase gross domestic product, and that's a sort of high level number, simple aggregation of economic activity that is deeply flawed. In fact, it overstates the amount of productive economic activity. If you strip down a little bit and you look at the key components, in the United States, the biggest component is household consumption, how much all of us spend each year to live, basically. And then another key component is what's called capital formation, how much you invest. And when you look at the size of household consumption in the U.S., it's massive. I mean, our household consumption alone, I think, is bigger than the total economic activity in any other country. So what that means is that there's a tremendous amount of there's a huge internal market in the United States that over the last, say, 20 years, 30 years, has increasingly been served by exports into our country or imports from other countries. And so China set itself up to say, you know, we're going to dominate the world. We'll invest a lot of money. We'll serve the U.S. and European and other markets from these factories that are based in China. But they failed, in my view, to consider that the internal market in China is still, even in 2015, the latest year for which comparable data for 200 countries at UNCTAD is available, the internal market in China is minuscule. So there's been this massive imbalance in China where they've been pumping out what they call capital formation in a disproportionately large amount, larger than any other major economy, say Japan in the 80s when they tried the same approach, way larger than that. As a result, I believe there's a lot of malinvestment in China, bad investment that'll never get a positive rate of return and may have to be written off. And again, China has, you know, it's got many benefits, but one of its problems is the size of the population there is massive. And while some of it has emigrated into the cities, there's still this gigantic rural population that's agriculture-based that hasn't made it into the market economy. And it's a very difficult challenge for a small group of people to ride herd on 1.3 billion people, many of whom have not seen the benefit of all these investments and must be growing weary of allegations of corruption and other problems. So I think the situation in China is far from rosy. We like to talk, and I think it's a fair comment, we like to talk about inequality in results, in consumption. Inequality, the top 10% of the economy typically will consume 30, maybe 40% of total consumption. So when you adjust for that in China, you discover that the actual, you know, bottom 90% of households in China are far poorer than the bottom 90% in the United States of America per household. And so the consumption patterns are different. And, you know, the Chinese have I think, misplayed a long-term strategy. They've invested too much too soon. And at a time when the largest market in the world, ours, our internal market, is operating with massive excess capacity itself. So, you know, over time, the forces, I think, was, I may have this wrong, but I think it was Adam Smith talked in the 18th century, I believe, about creative destruction. And that's the natural cycle of economics. You know, the people, when they're optimistic, they build too much, they invest too much. And then it comes a day of reckoning when, you know, people with debt have to pay their debts down and they can't. So countries find themselves in that position. Qatar, for example, is possibly in that position in the Middle East right now. Puerto Rico is in that position. Illinois is in that position. New York and California and Connecticut and other American states quickly find themselves in that type of position. And when the crunch comes and when the markets say, listen, you want more debt, you're going to have to pay up big time. Like Illinois right now, I think they're demanding 8% interest rates, which 1980 were not that high, but right now are, you know, almost usurious. So we will see creative destruction and we will see capacity taken out of the system. Those who are leveraged will, when indebted, are going to suffer. But I think out of it all, you know, they'll be paying for everybody, but our country's better positioned than most.
When we read about these international conventions and conferences, we're not reading about a collective effort here to, you know, like China, United States, other countries sitting down, watching these trends and knowing what is inevitable. We're not seeing much in the way of preventive action, where this very thing will be at the top of the list of discussions. It's almost like nobody wants to talk about it.
Yeah, right. The elephant in the room that is doing business, the wrong kind of business in the room, and nobody wants to discuss the large pile in the corner. But yeah, I mean, we don't have, you know, we barely have in this country a regulatory scheme. We have the appearance of regulation in the United States. We have the SEC, but the SEC can only by itself file civil actions. To get a criminal one across the line, they have to get the cooperation of the Department of Justice. We know from the work we've talked about in the past, the FDA, the Drug Administration, which I would argue should be robust, particularly given our aging population, is woefully underfunded and ineffective. The schemes to regulate these multinational businesses and even lending today are not up to the task. That's just inside our country when there is no international regulatory scheme. And, you know, I look at the G20 and the G8 and NATO and, you know, EU and all these different bureaucracies. NATO, I understand. The EU, I don't understand. And the G20 and the G8, I think, are a joke. I mean, it's just, do we really want to fire up Air Force One and all the other, you know, fleets of jets from countries around the world to consume the jet fuel and emit the emissions, to go to some fancy place so that a bunch of already coddled leaders can sit around and sign communiques and take pictures and, you know, buy souvenirs and issue pronouncements? I mean, I think it's distraction. And, you know, we should be focusing on problems in Toledo and Akron and, you know, the Midwest and the Northeast and around this country. We've got many, many issues that need to be addressed. And before we swan around with more, you know, gatherings of these world leaders, let's make some real progress. Let's force the people in Washington, D.C. You know, they're back for a few days before they go on another month-long vacation. Let's force these politicians to get to work in both parties, you know, and this endless resistance. You know, it's impossible for me to believe that there is no zone of compromise to improve the situation with healthcare. I just don't believe it. I don't believe there's no zone of compromise to fix this crazy tax system that seems to be a full employment exercise for accountants and lawyers and is a waste of a lot of our time. I mean, the average family spends a tremendous amount of time trying to figure out how to fill out all those forms. And the cost of doing so is never assessed. You know, there seem to be a lot of places where we should be able to make progress, and we need to make progress inside this country. And in other, you know, other countries have their own internal problems that need to be dealt with. You know, let's fix them first.
What is the window you see, if you could prognosticate a little bit and tell us, what is the window you see before catastrophe begins to show itself?
Well, I think that the danger, and the reason I'm amping up my warning, is there is a group of people, Mr. Soros and others. You know, George Soros broke the Bank of England famously and made $1 billion or pounds, and whatever that was, early 1990, I think, who like to bet against the fortunes of individual governments. And Mr. Soros is certainly not a fan of Donald Trump. So you can imagine a group of people with political interests saying, you know, the ticket here to destroy Trump is to, you know, trigger a crash. and then blame it all on Trump and hope that the average American voter in the 2018 will give, you know, maybe, you know, a majority in either the House or the Senate or both to Democrats. And with that, you can then begin a process of trying to impeach Trump or remove Trump or whatever. You could imagine a bunch of people believing that. I mean, I live here in Manhattan, and, you know, I don't have to imagine it. I mean, you see people talking about that approach. And so if you were somebody like Soros, who is already in this long, very long life, made a lot of money betting against the appreciation in prices, betting on disaster. There are actually firms. I think there's one called Jarch Capital, J-A-R-C-H Capital, which is housed with a bunch of, I think, prior Democrats or Democrats who literally bet on civil strife. You know, they're happy to see it because they can find ways to profit from it. So, you know, I'm just worried that the climate, which was trying to make in media and academia, in Wall Street, make the Obama administration look good, all the same tricks that could be made in the media, in academia, and in the markets to make somebody look good can be reversed and then used to usher in a crisis that would be devastating, perhaps worse than it needs to be, but could then be exploited by opponents of Trump.
But surely we're seeing signs now that are troubling enough to trigger probes and investigations and whatnot. We seem to have probes going on for everything now. But from what you're saying, we have enough of an inkling as to what is likely to happen in the very near future, some of the key players in this, where they're going with their plan to cause or to trigger a crisis. And then in turn, having forewarning themselves, because they're triggering this thing, they're well situated to deal with the fallout. But other people who are not operating that way, because they don't understand the sophistication of economics and Wall Street, people like me, we will know that it's happening when it's happening. Is there no way for the government to play a role here to forestall what you're describing?
Well, see, the government is the essential problem. The central banks and the governments have been acting even before President Obama, but certainly during every one of the 8 years of his terms. Our own government borrowed and spent recklessly. And, you know, when President Obama, I think, was inaugurated, we had about, from memory, $6 trillion in government debt. Now we have something like 20. So we're not in the same place. When President Obama was inaugurated at the end of the preceding year, interest rates were, you know, much higher than they are now. So the central bank in the United States, our Federal Reserve System, lowered our benchmark rate, thereby providing a cushion to the value of most assets. And those rates have, you know, been on the floor for a long, long time. They can go a little bit lower, but there's not the same cushion available to Trump to bring interest rates way down. Sadly, our Federal Reserve then, coordinated, it would seem, these policies with other large economies that also brought their interest rates down and also spent recklessly. And worse, some of these central banks, and I hope our own, not so much, but some of these central banks even started speculating in these overpriced equities, you know, common stocks and shares around the world. So, you know, we arrived at a party after, in quotes, a party after 8 years where, you know, we're out of food. We're out of food and drink. And the caterer is saying, you know, you guys have been eating and drinking for 8 years, you know, without paying your bills. You know, it's a lot of money, and you need to pay your bills. It's not like we have, you know, whether we can do this endlessly. And to make you feel better, or at least more comfortable, we're not in the worst position in this. The country that's in the worst position of all is Japan. Japanese debts are out of control high. far higher relative to economic activity than our own. And sadly, in Japan, the society there has been aging for a long, long time, meaning they haven't been having many children. So they find themselves in a weird position where there are actually many more people 65 and up than there are, 0 to 21. So you can't have a growing economy if you don't have, younger people having children and ideally having more children than the two in the couple. Because, it's tough to argue that you're going to have growing consumption if the population is shrinking. This doesn't make sense.
888-874-4888 is a number to call to speak with Charles Ortel. And Charles, if you don't mind, and I'm just usurping your time here. If you look like you might be able to accommodate us tomorrow to finish the second half of our discussion, which is politics and money and some pretty interesting people in the swill of it all. If you don't mind, consider yourself booked for tomorrow. For today, many people had been asking to have you available to talk about what you claim, and others are, I'm seeing others expressing similar views, and I'm seeing in the economic section or business section, many stores are closing already. Many chains are shutting down, letting go of their people. Others are, as you said earlier, others are changing their workforce and using more robots, kicking more people out the door. So you see all kinds of hints that as an industry, if you will, you see a reaction that spans across the country. And not just in this little town or that other city, but they're having broad impact now.
Yeah. I mean, well, I think a few things are happening. I'm a big fan of the science of demography. That is to say, every population is slightly different across the poorest countries in the world. Those are skewed heaviest to young people. And in general, in the richest countries in the world, those are skewed heaviest to older people, a process that has been going on for some time, for decades, and that actually has its roots going back, over 100 years. If you go back and you look at this data, which is very good, actually, and consistent, you'll see that in the late 1800s, early 1900s, before World War One, the makeup of America's population was like these poorer countries. It was skewed towards the young. And then we had a series of changes. We don't need to go into all the history, but starting around 1998 or so, the population bubble of people aged 55 or 65 and up has steadily been increasing as a percentage of, or in relation to the population bubble 25 to 54. Those people in general being the people who are most economically active. They consume the most. They get involved, buying and fixing up houses. They do things which can stimulate the overall economic activity. Whereas as we age, we tend to consume less, save more. The thing I like to say is, in this day and age, very few men actually wear a tie to work anymore, but men out there, when was the last time you bought a tie? And the similar sorts of decisions have been rippling through, I think, the economy at the same time that Bezos and others have figured out how to deliver products directly to your door without you having to get in your car or, pay for transportation to get to a place and then come back. You just, hook up on the internet. Next thing you know, you got groceries in your front door. So the age situation is changing and explains, I think, a lot, because as we age, we consume less. Consumption is the biggest piece of the economy. And then, as you say, the technology breakthroughs have changed the way in which the best of breed companies deliver goods and services directly to your door. So we're going through disruption in the private sector, yet in government and in academia, we're locked into a system that made sense when America was agrarian. You know, we have a school year that gives you the summer off. We have, we have a government that was sized, particularly city and state governments that were sized to 1945 activity, 1950 activity, and we have a private public sector that's resistant to change.
Well, this means that we have to, on an individual basis, we have to do something to prepare ourselves. What is your question for Charles Ortel? Ask it at 888-874-4888. E from Edgewater, you're on the air with Charles Ortel.
Thank you. Hi, Eutrice. Hi, Charles. Thanks for all your great work there doing.
Thank you. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
What's your question?
My question is, now that we know what we didn't know 8 to 6 months ago about James Comey, that I feel he should be on trial for what's the term, obstruction of justice, of interfering with the election twice with the emails that we thought he was on our side, Donald Trump thought he was on our side, that we were trying to get Hillary and Bill investigated. And he said he had plenty of things to look at. It looks like something was going to happen. Now, you know where I'm going to. He's messed up, and then within 2 days, everything's fine. There's nothing really to bother the Clintons about. He's the judge, jury, and executioner about everything going on in the United States. What gives James Comey this power? And what do you think needs to be done about him? That's my question.
Great. Well,
we have a question for you, Charles, that anticipates our program tomorrow, but let's get it answered today.
I see ahead sometimes. I'm sorry that I sometimes end up
all right.
With these kinds.
What I'm saying is you were very, very skillful at sneaking in the question ahead of time. Very good. But here's Charles's answer.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. So when you look into James Comey, and initially when I started on the work on the Clinton Foundation, I had just a gut feeling that I couldn't trust James Comey. You know, people would ask me, why don't you take your files down to the FBI? And I'd be like, who am I going to give them to? I don't know whether, you know, the people I might meet in the FBI are good actors or bad actors. And in James Comey, when you look into his history, as I have been doing, and I several months ago, actually, I think on Eutrice's show and also in the media, in the print media, I called for James Comey to be fired before he was fired. And I think it's a good thing he was fired, because when you go back into his long history, he was involved in my view, or he was, some might argue that he has been covering for the Clintons and their associates for a long time. When you go into what's called the FBI Vault file, which is something that's available online and for free, and you Google that or search that for the William J. Clinton Foundation, you'll find over 600 pages of heavily redacted notes that in two separate dumps, I think one like 100 so pages, the other 500 so pages. But if you spend the time that I spent on it, you'll see that there was an active investigation in early 2001, right after it was revealed that Bill Clinton had pardoned the fugitives, Mark Rich and his associate, Mr. Green. And the FBI stepped it up. I mean, they had all kinds of subpoenas and documents granted to them, and there seemed to be a lot of activity. Then on September 4th, Robert Mueller was appointed the head of the FBI. We had, of course, September 11 events, which disrupted a lot of, it was horrible what happened, obviously, but as a narrow point, the FBI offices, I think, were negatively affected by the disaster down there in the World Trade Center. And then James Comey was transferred from Richmond, I believe it was, up to the Southern District of New York to lead the investigation into the Clinton Foundation. He took official authority, I believe, early in January 2002, but he was briefed, according to these notes I just told you about, in December of, I think, the 11th of December or thereabouts, 2001. So, you know, with what I've just been spending the last 7 days or so going back over some notes in that time frame, and with what I see in the public domain, you know, I have enough information to, I think, you know, with a legal team, put the Clintons and their trustees away for a long time. Why was it that James Comey could, with the resources of the FBI, with a seated grand jury, with you know, all the considerable tools that he had at that time frame, why could he see what I see plainly? And why did it then take so long for him to, I would argue, potentially slow walk an investigation, during which time it allowed the Clinton Foundation to get ever more involved in what I believe are fraudulent activities? And then why did he wait until November 18th, 2004 or thereabouts, he and his team, to make the incorrect conclusion of abandoning the investigation? It makes no sense. And, you know, a lot of the people who are now, in theory, directing this Russia probe, Mueller, Comey triggered it, and Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, I believe all have conflicts here. You know, so you raise a great question, and I hope the listeners are going to follow up and look at the FBI vol file, see what I'm talking about. And, you know, I think when people wake up and do work for themselves and don't wait for the, you know, the branded and the big three networks to tell them what the truth is, when we see the truth staring us in the face, then we can start putting pressure on these people to do the right thing. I think, you know, you're absolutely right. Mr. Comey and many other people deserve incredibly tough scrutiny. There needs to be a thorough investigation, and if prosecutions are warranted, they should be waged, and they should be won.
Thank you. Did that satisfy you, Edie?
Could I say one more thing?
Sure.
Not only did he disrupt everything with the election and cause us to have Hillary slipping through our fingers like sand, but he also is causing a very big disruption with another nation, Russia, which is like the second biggest power, and we're pretty much on good terms. And I like Donald Trump's attitude of wanting to stay on good terms with them. And here is this Comey guy under oath saying he's 100% sure, 100% sure that they have something to do with something without any evidence. You don't do that when you're under oath. If you're at a dinner table, you can say what you want. He's under oath. He needs to have proof. And until that proof is presented, I want something to be done about this. That's all I got to say today. Thank you very much. And
thank you for your call. Michael from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Trace, and hi, Mr.
Charles Ortel.
Charles. My question is this, you know, and I've always pondered about this, that certain areas of the economy are able to inflate while other areas, you know, deflate or just go on and on, you know, a flat line for years and years and years. And it seems to me that, you know, these kind of areas that are allowed to inflate certain sectors of the economy, like education, healthcare, telecommunications, cable, television, certain things, internet. Some areas are allowed to, you know, inflate, and yet they don't make utilities out of them. They make private sector, you know, profits where the, you know, investors make huge amounts of money. So my question is, you know, if you're a massage therapist, let's say you haven't had an increase in the price you can charge for 20, 25 years. But in the healthcare industry, medical devices and things, there's huge amounts of increase. So it doesn't seem like the market forces generally control this. And regulations are completely, with the government, are completely, you know, they're controlled by the lobbyists and the influence peddlers. So there doesn't seem to be a natural fix for this in the economy, and legislatures won't do anything about it.
Those are some great points. So, you know, let's key on education to start with. So we went down a path of saying, you know, we're going to have student loans for everybody. We're going to set them up, I would argue, on a basis that is outrageous, where you cannot discharge a student loan in bankruptcy, meaning that if, you know, you are not thinking clearly at age 17 or 18 when you go to a school and you spend your time in the bar and instead of in the library, and you pick a major where you've got no hope of actually getting a high-paying job, and you find yourself at the end of 4 years with $150,000 in student loans, you can't go through bankruptcy to get rid of it. You, for the rest of your life, you'll be saddled with that loan. That what that has done, coming at a time when also the great universities, the brand name universities across this country, have a global market. You know, they were sized in the main to serve the U.S. market, but all of a sudden, the rising rich and the rising rich around the world want to send their boys and their girls, or men and their women, to American universities. So there's a tremendous demand for these coveted spots. And the academic world then, you know, which is already using a tenure system that I think deserves to be revisited in 2017, but using this tenure system, there's no downward pressure on their compensation. And you look at these great universities, I was fortunate to go to two of them, and, you know, I don't want to bore you with all the details, but I can tell you that many of these professors, tenure professors, spend very little time teaching and a lot of time speechifying and being a consultant and being an advisor and all these for-profit-making operations. So the ticket out of, you know, the massage therapist's room into a higher-paying job, that is to say a good education, has been tremendously inflated in cost, far faster than inflation, to the benefit of the educator, not to the benefit of the student. So that's one area. In the healthcare field, you know, we're having a rancorous debate now, we've had it for a while, over insurance, which misses the point. The point is that the cost of care needs to be brought down, not the insurance of the cost of care. So the attitudes we have in this country are that if you get sick, you know, you should just be able eventually to go get treatment, and your insurance carrier will figure out, you know, whether the price is fair or not fair. And that's we don't do that in any other major sector of the economy, and the results are seen. You can, as you point out, healthcare costs as a share of total consumption have risen geometrically for way too long. To fix that, you got to fix the cost of care. I think you got to have more doctors, less bureaucracy. More nurses, less bureaucracy. You've got to give people incentives. We got to get tough on and make examples of people who are involved in the abusing the existing healthcare systems that we have, these doctors and others engaged in Medicare fraud, Medicaid fraud, things like that. And we've got to have as a goal not, you know, encouraging people to sign up for very expensive insurance policies. The goal should be to bring the cost of care down. You mentioned telecommunications. You know, cell phone and telephone communications have dropped enormously in cost. There are other things in our economy have dropped enormously in cost. Why is it that healthcare costs need to go up relentlessly? Education, those are the two fastest growing components of cost for all Americans. It seems to me, rather than fighting about whether, you know, we have a good or a bad insurance system to cover those costs, that's a second order set of issues. We should be understanding, you know, why is it that tuition costs need to soar? Why is it that, you know, hospital rates and procedure costs need to soar? Does it make sense?
No, Charles. But what about, you know, in Nixon's time, they had price controls you know, when you have industries like the two we mentioned, education and healthcare, when they're exponentially exploding and bankrupting people and causing dislocation in the economy, imbalance, enormous imbalance, can it be argued that these things should be regulated like utilities, controlled? price controls, or is that, you know, is that, are we heading down the wrong path there? Because these other, these natural forces, market forces, are not working. It's corruption because you have the politicians, grease palms, greasing other palms, and it's getting up, and it's causing tremendous imbalances and dislocations. I'm not sure those are the only two. There may be others, but it's those two especially are just causing tremendous dislocation in the economic well-being of the country.
So price control seldom works is the history of, it doesn't mean they could never work, but they seldom work. I mean, we're around the world, the one thing that, always seems to happen is the so-called unregulated black underground market. You're always going to get around price controls one way or another. But I would argue that what's going on now is not a testament to the fact that the market is broken. It's testament to the fact that we don't really have a free market. We have a warped market. There's too much cronyism. There's not enough effective regulation. The systems of checks and balances are not there. Bankers make money no matter what happens. And when things fall apart, they're not punished. To pick on, I used to be a banker, just to pick on one profession. We really, as I mentioned earlier in the show, the FDA is not up to the task. The SEC is not up to the task. So rather than price controls, which I think are dangerous, I think we need to have, more tougher enforcement of laws that are on the books. Utrecht and I have talked at length about the foundation scandals, and the foundation sector is a gigantic piece of the whole puzzle. Warren Buffett was just in the press today, supposedly taking credit for giving, $3 billion to the Gates Foundation. When, really what he's giving stock that is appreciated so much in value that when he gives this gift, he gets a write-off against his tax return. So it's not, he's not being all that generous giving this away. Yes, I suppose it's nice what he's doing, but on the other hand, the press isn't focused on the fact that Bill Melinda Gates and he, control the entity to which he's giving the stock. So what's he really doing? So, I think there are some bigger, bolder moves in new areas. It's, reforming charities, reforming the tax system, thinking out of the box, not simply about insurance in education, but in healthcare, but in lowering the cost of care, that will have far more positive benefit than any system of price regulation, in my view.
Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. Stay tuned. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Charles, tomorrow, get ready. It's going to be politics, and she's back. You know who I
mean. I'll look forward to it.
All right. Thanks so much, everyone, for your questions. And again, my apologies. I have no idea what happened there, but some kind of a glitch that robbed us of very precious time. So we'll make up for it one way or the other. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.